88.3 Southern FM, you're on the Community Block. My name is Peter Tolich. I'm filling in for the much-travelled Colin Tyrus, who's winging his way from Hong Kong to London at this very moment. My very first guest on the Community Block today is Amanda Bast. Hopefully I've got that correctly. She is with the Better Health Network, which is a non-for-profit organisation. Is there much more to know about BHN than I've already introduced as being just a non-profit organisation?
No.
Good afternoon. Welcome first.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And I've already got to correct you. It's Amy. Almost.
Amy. What did I say?
Amanda. I'll take it. That's fine. Okay. That's fine. It's my pseudonym. No, thank you for having me. Yeah, I work for Better Health Network. So I'm in the health promotion team there. But we are a community health organisation that services five local catchment areas. So from City of Port Phillip, City of Stonnington, Glen Ira, City of Kingston and City of Bayside, so quite a big sweep. We have lots of allied health professionals along with dentists, GPs, and great community access.
How long have you been with these guys?
I have been here for 10 and a half years.
So we're, I know. what was the lead up to joining BHN for you?
Yeah, so we've recently been through a big merger. So previously I was at our legacy organisation and I was predominantly in South Melbourne, working across Stonnington and Port Phillip. So my background's in postgraduate of human nutrition and then I did my master's in health promotion.
So this is obviously a natural progression.
Yeah. And then I've stayed ever since.
Okay. Well, take me through some of the stuff that BHN does. What's the most important? What's priority number one for BHN?
Yeah, I guess priority number one for BHN and us specifically as a health promotion team is equitable access for everyone. So that looks really different for different population groups. In the health promotion team, I oversee our equitable food environments portfolio. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of work that we do across early childhood education and care settings and schools, and also the wider community. Our work is primarily focused on supporting early childhood education and care teachers and staff, along with families, in building up a positive food environment for children so that they can grow to not only love and explore food confidently, but they can build a really trusted and respectful relationship with their bodies.
I can't believe that people don't trust food.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? I think food's one of those things that it's a necessity, but it's become really, really complex and confusing for a lot of people. We're handed down so much information. I'm a mum of two and I'm not working, and it is confusing. You get assessed and monitored all through pregnancy about what you're eating. You then get monitored by the hospital. You then get advice from maternal and child health nurse. Mm. And then you land at a kinder or a long daycare when you finally return to work and you're getting more information about food. So we've forgotten what it's like to connect with food and connect with our bodies.
Actually, saying that, my oldest daughter is pregnant at the moment and she's going through that. You know, I can't eat cheese and
a couple meats. Other things.
Yeah.
Deli what, meats.
So when was that a thing? I can't remember. Well, I was going to say I can't remember my mother doing that. I'd be in trouble if I could. But when did that become a thing?
Yeah, I think there is really great evidence in some of the nutrition and dietetic knowledge we have now. Like, it's really, really robust. And as we learn things over time, the evidence adapts and changes with most up-to-date research. So what informs pregnancy is founded on the most latest evidence, with really strict guidance as well mandated. So, but it does get really confusing as you get sort of more finicky. Like, I can't eat sushi from the deli at the supermarket, but I can go out and have Nobu sushi because it's fresher. Like, it just gets a lot more food rules and sort of that food morality and food judgment. But in terms of safety when you're pregnant, I'd say follow the doctor's advice.
That would play with my mind.
Yeah. I think that's what we've found. The key project that I lead is called Mealtime Expectations with my colleague Kayla. We developed it a few years ago, and it's all centered around the belief systems that we hold around mealtimes and food and bodies. So we work really closely with long daycares and kindergartens, both the teachers, the cook, and then also the families. And what we do is we unpack what mealtimes were like. What were they like growing up? What do you expect them to be like? What are they like now at home? So are they calm? Do children sit at the table? Or do they feel like chaos? Do they feel rushed? Do they feel busy? And we also unpack those with educators. So we make sure that we've had perspective of all groups involved in feeding children. And we actually try to create alignment. So we make sure that everyone's really clear around the expectations for children. So, for example, we might have children are really noisy, or this two-year-old keeps wanting to get up and leave the table. And when we come in and reflect on that, we're like, that's actually pretty normal. A two-year-old is going to want to get up and leave the table and then come back. Our job is to not overreact, not to force them to eat, not to over-police what they're eating. We unpack all the stories that both educators and families had growing up around finish what's on your plate.
Mm-hmm.
There's starving kids somewhere else, so make sure you eat it. And we were sort of programmed to have a really, this and that relationship with food. We were never sort of taught to trust our bodies and to trust our hunger and fullness, or taught that. So our job with these local settings is to actually come in, work with the education staff, work with the families, challenge some of those belief systems that we have, and then do a lot of capacity building and information sharing, and then align values so that it's really clear for children what's going to happen at the education setting and then at home.
So can the kids rebel about what you're teaching them as opposed to what they get at home and vice versa? Does that come into play?
We've piloted at a school, and that was really great. So far we've had no rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
What we do try to do is give voice and perspective take to everyone involved in feeding children. We know from research from Alan Satter, her principle is division of responsibility. So that speaks to the role of the caregiver or the role model around a child. So the role model around a child, so that's the educator or the parent or family, they're responsible for what food is being served. So sourcing the appropriate food within their budget, within their means, within the time that they have. They provide where the food is served. So whether that be at a dinner table with the rest of the family, whether that be on the couch for movie night, and when that food is served. So it's at 6 o'clock every night or 4:30 when you get home and you're all tired, whatever that looks like for your family, that is a decision of that care provider, so the family or the parent. And the child gets to decide if they eat, how much they eat, and in what order they eat.
Mm.
So if they have one bite and say, all done, it is up to the parent or the caregiver to say, okay, I'll leave it here and you can come back if you're still hungry later. With our work, as soon as we sort of highlight that to people, that you actually have really clear roles in feeding children, free from pressure and prompting, like try some, that's not in our role, which is a bit of undoing for a lot of people.
A couple of questions have come out of that for me. When we had children, we were taught that there was no order. So, you know, if you want to serve dessert first, you serve dessert first, as long as the child was eating.
Yeah.
Is that still stand up as being correct?
Yeah, it's a really great strategy. Mm. That's what we have a lot of families specifically will say, my child just keeps asking for ice cream. They just want ice cream. And our advice is to serve ice cream with the main meal.
Yep.
Serve it alongside it. It's not a hierarchy or a moralization of food, because then it does put the dessert or the after dinner food on a pedestal. So it does make it into more of a, I'm doing lots of quotations, a treat, instead of just another food.
Mm.
Like it's just protein, dairy, a little bit of sugar. It's fine.
What about the child that wants to have the iPad in front of them while they eat?
Yeah. You see that a bit now at restaurants as well. I think with a lens of neurodiversity, it is really, really common for some children to need sensory stimuli while eating. So it can be really common to have that distraction, because eating in itself is really overstimulating. So for neurodivergent children, some won't prioritize eating. So actually having headphones on and a screen will get some food into them, free from pressure again, but it will make it a lot of like a calmer mealtime for the child to reduce some of that external stimuli. Again, we work in a way that is like meeting settings and families where they're at. We don't want to come in with a new set of rules and say, needs to be screen free, needs to be all of these things. It needs to be at the table. If I remember, we had one parent reflect that it was really liberating to let go of all the rules. And she was she's a practicing dietitian, and she said that I knew all of the theory and all of the evidence, and I've got one child that eats in their bedroom with an iPad while eating dinner, and the other one will sit at the table, and they might rotate, but that's what they need for now.
Mm-hmm.
Our job as parents, or when we facilitate these sessions with educators, is to still provide that safe eating space, wherever that may be and what it might look like. So still inviting them to the table if that's something they're comfortable with, making sure they're safe and supported to eat, sharing conversations, trying to make it as less of a barrier for them to come to the table. If they come to the table and feel like they're going to be told or pressured to eat certain foods, or it's a really sort of heightened environment, they're less likely to come.
Are there stages to this with children? Like, as in, as kids get older, you have a 6 week cycle, yeah, and everything changes. Is eating the same thing?
Yeah, really, really similar. And I was speaking to our pediatric dietitian just before I came in, and she was saying that one of the really common things to hear from parents is that when they're introducing solids, so all of the advice you get on when your child starts introducing solids is to give them lots of variety. So you're giving them tastes of a whole diverse range of foods. And then the assumption is that those children will keep eating all of those foods. But as we know, children's intake and food preferences really, really vary over time. So one day they could love a particular food, the next day not. One day they might eat a lot of a food, the next day not. So we should really expect to see peaks and troughs in both intake and food preference, so those favourite foods.
As grandparents,
yeah,
how should we look at this now? Because it's totally different to the way we grew up and were educated or not educated to food.
Is there
something that we should take from all this, and how do we adapt? If there is any adapting to be done, obviously there is.
Yeah, I mean, it depends. I'm sure there's plenty that are doing a fantastic job. Like you were saying, you grew up on a farm. I think it's getting back to basics. It doesn't have to be complicated. So with the food learning side of stuff and the language we use around food, keeping it really, really simple. So grandparents are great. My mother and my mother-in-law, they're amazing with cooking with my kids. My mother-in-law is an amazing gardener, so she's got a huge herb garden, and they're constantly picking foods. That food learning in teaching children where food comes from, it doesn't have to be teaching them the nutrient density of the food. They can just know where it comes from, because a lot of kids might not see that. Like building a meal, what that looks like. As kids get a little bit older, so probably more primary school years, teaching them how to build a meal, a bit of this, a bit of that, bit of that, will keep you full for a long time. It's not a hierarchy of good and bad. The language that grandparents can sometimes use does get us into a little bit of a pickle in terms of we're just having a treat. We try to steer away from that language and just call food what it is. So
the big umbrella.
Time for ice cream.
Yep. And that was, as I said, I grew up on a farm, and that was it. Everything for us was available. You just hopped out the backyard, and there were tomato plants, there was carrots in the ground, and watermelon was, summertime it was there, and you just cut it up. So to me, a supermarket wasn't where my food came from. So I knew the chain of events, and then watched my mother cook. But not everybody has that facility. It's city kids just don't see it. So they have to relearn, whereas for us it's a different part of the chain.
Yeah, exactly. And there's some really great programs happening across kindergartens and long daycares, like Stephanie Alexander and even primary schools, Stephanie Alexander's Kitchen Garden and food growing and things like that, to try to get that hands-on food learning a lot more integrated into how children learn about food without all of the morality and the shaming around good or bad foods. Yeah.
We're just about to go to a break. I want to touch on the nutrition updated policy and more into that after we have a little break. I'm talking to Amy, not Amanda Bass from the Better Health Network. And this is the Community Block on a Tuesday afternoon. As I said, I'm Peter Tolich, filling in for the voice of Melbourne Trams, Colin Tyrus, who is away for a couple of weeks. But hopefully we will get things right with Amanda's name, which is actually Amy. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
And you're in the Community Block on a Tuesday afternoon at 22 past 2. I'm Peter Tolich, and with me is Amy Bast from the Better Health Network. That's a very British Bast, isn't it? Or Bast. It spells Bast, but it pronounces as Bast. We are talking about all things mealtime expectations, and now we will touch on the updated nutrition policy, which has happened recently. How recent was that been updated?
Yeah, so it was a really big project from end of last year. So it was around September, October last year, and we just finalised it and launched it in February. So
is that a state thing or a national thing?
National. So it was with Early Learning Association of Australia. So they are Victorian-based, but their policy suite is available nationally. And it was really informed by a lot of our work on the ground in what we've been doing locally with early childhood educators and families. And it really helped see the limitations that were happening in policy across kindergarten. So there was a lot of rigid framing of foods, so healthy eating instead of just nutritious and diverse. There was a lot of limit discretionary and like negative framing of foods instead of just promoting what we want to see. There was a lot
What's a negative framing of food?
Yeah, so like we call a negative framing of food like the moralising of food, so putting things in goods and bad buckets, which does lead to feelings of guilt and shame. So if you've got a child that brings a packed lunchbox into a setting and the teacher walks around and says, oh, who's got a nice colourful lunchbox, and you've got a child here with might just have crackers, chips, slices of cheese and a jam sandwich, which my son takes to primary school every single day, and that child doesn't get the compliments on their lunchbox, children in the early years will internalise those feelings. So if their lunchbox isn't a good one, they internalise that they're not good and that somehow their parent or caregiver has failed them in a way. Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I experienced something similar at primary school because I come from a European background. We didn't have a sliced toast, so a sliced bread. Yeah. So we had the big cut loaves, and we copped a whole lot of bullying because our sandwiches looked totally different to the Aussie kids.
Yeah, yeah, and we still see that today.
Wow.
We still see that today. A lot of it comes up in, services where, so usually kindergartens where children bring food in from home, and we definitely saw it in the primary schools that we work with. A lot of sort of food comparison, and our phrase is don't yuck somebody else's yum.
Great line.
Yeah, yeah. Insofar as like even educators commenting on how much or how little children should be eating at a particular mealtime. So we get a lot of the like, oh, save some for later, or are you eating all of that now? And it always makes us encourage people to just zoom out a little bit. So we don't know what else is happening in that child's life. We don't know if they skipped breakfast. We don't know if they were an early riser and had breakfast at 5 a.m. So they're really fueling up. Yes, they might eat all of their lunchbox by 11 a.m., but then it's having a conversation with the parent or caregiver and saying, can you pack a little bit more food next time? So throughout our work, we're always unpicking where that arises, so where that food comparison or that food judgment might come up.
Do you encourage a yum cha situation where, or tapas, where you're sharing with other kids? Is that a thing?
Not usually now, mainly because of allergies or intolerances.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So there is like some settings we'll do food provision. So they display what's on the menu and they'll have an on-site cook and they will provide all of the food. But there is still really specific allergy considerations to make. So, yeah, even children that bring food in with lunchboxes, they usually don't share. It's not like, back in the day when you'd food trade if you had something you didn't want in your lunchbox. Mm.
I'd have food envy.
Yeah.
Like if I saw some sushi
normal sized bread or the thinner sliced bread.
Exactly. So that's obviously something that's in my past.
Yeah, yeah. But that just goes to show, like, we bring so much history into the way that we eat or the way that we feed children or what we observe in others. But we also do evolve over time. We learn new evidence. We have learnt that the rate of eating disorders and disordered eating is skyrocketing.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So what we've been doing in terms of just drilling it into people about eat this, eat this, eat this, instead of actually like how you come together and eat and the practice of knowledge around meal times and food environments, I think that's sort of been lacking.
And this should flow on to adulthood, shouldn't it, for kids?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. It should really set them up in having a really positive relationship with food or a trusted relationship with food, because growing up, it isn't something that has been moralised for them, or they haven't had to earn something. So if we encourage the caregivers around children to not use food as a bribe or a reward, so when you get to the car, you'll get your chocolate Freddo, or if you're good while we're out, I'll get you an ice cream. Like, it's never, oh, if you're good when we're out, I'll get you a bag of apples.
Yep.
Like, that's never the bribe. So if we remove those bribes and things like that, it's really giving children the message that all food fits in a balanced way, and knowing that the educators and the family around the children are those role models. Mm-hmm. So seeing what adults around them eat, so seeing what you eat at dinner time, children are always watching. Seeing what I pack for lunch when I go to work, my children see me pack my son's lunchbox, they see me pack my lunchbox. They're like, okay, that's how they collect their data and what's going to be their blueprint.
What about the child that sees eating as, for want of a better word in parentheses, a waste of time because they're too busy doing other things?
Yeah, that's really common. So how to like invite them to eating really safely in a way that's non-pressured. And I always say that if there's ever any concerns or any red flags, you can always refer in. We've got an amazing pediatric dietitian team, and we've also got like a program called Messy Munches, which is like a group program, like a six-week program to come in and support parents that are really kind of in that sticking point. But if you've done your sort of umbrella things, like your positive food environments, you're making it non-pressurized, you're inviting them to the table safely, you're offering foods that are new alongside foods that they love, like might be strawberries or crackers that they absolutely love, making it a really safe and inviting time for them. If you've tried all of that and you're still like, they just keep running away, or they're extremely heightened, or they're really constipated, or if you see some other things go off, then you get support. Yeah.
Amy, there is so much to talk about. We've run out of time. Amy Bass from the Better Health Network. In closing, is there anything I've missed, anything that you'd like to add?
No, I think that's it. If anyone's out there that uses the ALA policy, we really do hope they land well and help really inform and shift some of the practice at your kinder or long daycare.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Hopefully we'll see you next month.
Thank you.